oftentimes people in our party like to complain that, you know, voters have moved away from us. That's not the voters' fault. That is our fault as a party. If we are not speaking to their needs, if we are not providing a vision that they can see themselves in and can buy into, then that's on us.
Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened.
There is not a liberal America and a conservative America. There is the United States of America.
Good night and good luck.
Hey, folks, it's Rick Wilson. Welcome back once again to the Lincoln Project Podcast. I am super excited to be joined today by James Tallarico, who is a newly announced candidate for the United States Senate in the great state of Texas. He is a communicator and a legislator and a leader of a form that I think a lot of people didn't believe the Democrats still had in them. He goes where places Democrats fear to tread, and that is talking to working folks, talking to folks, people of faith, talking to folks across the political spectrum.
The biggest divide in our country is not left versus right. It's top versus bottom. Yeah. Billionaires want us looking left and right at each other so that we're not looking up at them. The people at the top work so hard to keep us angry and divided because our unity is a threat to their wealth and their power. So their social media algorithms and their cable news networks tear us apart. They divide us by party, by race, by gender, by religion, so that we don't notice that they're defunding our schools, gutting our health care, and cutting taxes for themselves and their rich friends. It is the oldest strategy in the world: divide and conquer. But we will not be conquered. We're underdogs in this fight. We're going up against those billionaire mega donors and their puppet politicians. We're going up against a rigged system, and we're going up against a lot of money. But I'm a former middle school teacher. I don't scare easily. And Texans don't scare easily. My granddad was a Baptist preacher in South Texas. He taught me that we follow a barefoot rabbi who gave two commandments: love God and love neighbor. Because there is no love of God without love of neighbor. Every single person bears the image of the sacred. Every single person is holy. Not just my neighbors who look like me, or pray like me, or vote like me. Those billionaires are trying to keep us from seeing all that we have in common. They're trying to keep us from realizing that there is far more that unites us than divides us. Because once we do, we will come together across party, across race, across gender, across religion, to take power back for ourselves and our communities. 2,000 years ago, when the powerful few rigged the system, that barefoot rabbi walked into the seat of power and flipped over the tables of injustice. To those who love this state, to those who love this country, to those who love our neighbors, it's time to start flipping tables.
James, first off, welcome to the Lincoln Project Podcast. Thank you so much for coming on. I want to just ask you right off the bat, why are you the guy to take on either Cornyn or Paxton, depending on how that shakes out, and the sort of Republican National Committee or Senate Committee war machine in this election?
Well, thank you for having me. I'm a huge fan of the work that y'all do. And I decided to get in this race because I firmly believe that all 30 million Texans deserve a U.S. senator who's going to represent their interests and not the interests of billionaire mega donors. And Ken Paxton and John Cornyn have both forfeited the right to be the senator from this great state. They're both more interested in serving their mega donors and serving the people of Texas. And I think the country is looking for a reset. from the Democratic Party. So I hope to provide a new kind of message, a new kind of campaign that people can believe in again. We desperately need that in this state and in this country at this critical moment.
When you came across my radar screen the first time, I was very impressed because you were not ashamed of your faith. You were not hiding it. You would go to talk to working folks where they were, not going into these conversations defensively, but rather with a very open heart to talk to people who might not consider themselves Democrats, might not consider themselves anything but conservatives. But you won over people, even in your state work, who were who I think understood right away that you were somebody who would listen and meet them where they were to talk things through. How do you scale that up in a race in a state as big as Texas, with the stakes as high as they will be, and with having to go out and address 30 million people instead of the folks in a legislative district?
Right. It's not going to be easy, and I'm going to need a lot of people's help. I cannot do this alone. And I think just in the first 24 hours of this campaign, we have seen an overwhelming response from people across Texas and, frankly, across the country.
It has been a few years since Texas Democrats have turned out like this. 1,000 or so people in Round Rock Tuesday evening to see James Tallarico launch his campaign for U.S. Senate. A self-described underdog in his race against Colin Allred to be the Democratic nominee and then take on either John Cornyn or Ken Paxton.
It brings an injection of excitement, you know, and that's good for the Democratic Party. That's good for the Democratic primary. That's ultimately good for Texas.
This morning, Tallarico says his campaign has already raised more than $1 million from small dollar donors. But in the first 12 to 24 hours of his campaign, which shows momentum,
folks have signed up to volunteers. I've been so blown away by the number of volunteer signups we've gotten. So I think people are ready to do something. They're ready to join a campaign that's different from all the other campaigns we've seen in recent years. And it feels like people are starved of hope and of optimism. And if we can provide that to people, I think we can pull something together that will change the politics of this state and of this country. And Rick, you know this, but I did this when I first got elected. I flipped a Trump district that no one thought was winnable.
A fresh face to politics is already making waves in Central Texas. He flipped a seat in the Texas House from red to blue. On top of that, he is the youngest member of the Texas legislature. KVU political reporter Ashley Godot is here. And Ashley, we're talking about James Tallarico.
That's right, Mike. The young Democrat was sworn into office this afternoon.
I, James Tallarico,
do solemnly swear
that I will faithfully execute the duties
of the office of Representative District 52.
Tallarico took that oath of office today instead of in January, when the rest of the freshman class will, because he's filling the seat vacated by Representative Larry Gonzalez. You'll recall Gonzalez resigned in June after serving for 7 years. Now, Tallarico is a former public school teacher. He wants to use his experience to help fix the school finance system, and he delivered a strong message at today's ceremony.
The current political landscape is too small for Texas, far too small. Our politics are narrow-minded and short-sighted. With every border wall, with every bathroom bill, we degrade our reputation and we dishonor our legacy.
Now, I sat down with the 29-year-old after his swearing in. He says lawmakers need to focus on policies to help make Texas schools, the economy, and families stronger.
I was told it was impossible, just like I'm being told this is impossible. But my life has shown me that you should always bet on the underdogs. And this is certainly going to be an underdog fight in this election.
I think people don't really understand that Texas, yes, it is a red state in many, many ways, but it has a much larger working class vote out there, both in the metro areas and in rural areas, that have not really been served by the fact that, you know, either a Ken Paxton or John Cornyn has a very small constituency. And those folks have actually been on kind of on the, especially I think in the last year or two, or the last year, especially in the rural and the agricultural community, they're really getting stuck hard
That's right.
by policies that aren't meant for them, but are meant for the folks who can write a million-dollar super PAC check.
That's exactly right. We've gotten this reputation as a state for being deep red, and that's not really borne out by the data. I mean, we're much more of a pink state than we are a red state. I remember growing up here, Democratic candidates would lose by 25, 30 points.
Sure.
And now consistently, these statewide races are single-digit races. And so the trend line is unmistakable. Our elections are getting much more competitive in Texas. And my party obviously likes to talk about turning Texas blue, and Republicans talk about keeping Texas red. I think the best color for Texas is purple. I think she would look great in purple because, as you said, when there's competitive elections, when politicians are on their toes, they serve the people that they're supposed to be representing. They compete for every vote, and they pass policies that are designed to appeal to the largest number of Texans. And that's good for the people of this state, both people in urban and suburban areas, but also particularly for people in small towns around Texas, where you've seen rural hospitals close at an alarming rate. You've seen local public schools closing because these billionaire mega donors have been pushing a private school voucher scam in our state and shutting down the neighborhood schools in these small towns, and therefore shutting down Friday Night Lights, which is a way that we bring people together in an age when so many of us are being torn apart. So yeah, there's so much on the line, and I think a competitive race and more competitive elections will lead to better policies for the people of Texas.
You know, I think folks, Trump won Texas by 53%. It was not a wipeout, absolute nuclear bomb, considering this is a bastion state for the Republicans. So, you have two Republicans, John Cornyn, who I've known a long time, who sort of transformed himself from a traditional Bush-style Republican into a guy who does what Trump wants.
Yep.
And you've got Ken Paxton, who is in any just world would not be in an elected office, but would rather be picking up trash by the side of the road wearing an orange vest. He's been impeached. He's gotten bought his way out of it a couple times.
To pinpoint the one thing that led Texas Republicans to impeach their own attorney general, you need only go back a few months when Ken Paxton asked state lawmakers to pay $3.3 million so he could settle a lawsuit brought by former employees of his who blew the whistle on him.
I'm just trying to get some clarity. Is the case against the state of Texas, or is it against General Paxton?
Really, the whole thing comes down to having Texas pick up the bill for, firing the whistleblowers.
So Paxton asks for taxpayer money to be spent on his own legal settlement.
If this legislative body does not vote to pay that, then what would be the next steps? What will happen then?
House Republicans refuse and quietly open an investigation into the attorney general. The result of the legislature's investigation, that is what led to the 20 articles of impeachment. But let's back up here and put the pieces of this puzzle together. It mainly centers around one of Paxton's many political donors, a man named Nate Paul. Prosecutors say Paxton went out of his way to help Paul, did things for him as attorney general that benefited Paul, not taxpayers. Things such as blocking public information requests to protect Nate Paul's records in the Texas Department of Public Safety, writing an official legal opinion as attorney general to protect Nate Paul's properties from foreclosure, and appointing a special prosecutor, among other things, to investigate issues for Nate Paul.
What in the world do you think Ken Paxton saw in Nate Paul?
Look, he clearly should have had better judgment about Nate Paul. Obviously, he's facing very serious problems right now. There was chatter and I think doubt about his business empire, how quickly he emerged as a major player, really kind of out of nowhere, and the way he was operating, his flashy lifestyle. So I do think he probably showed some poor judgment there and perhaps, trusting Nate Paul's word as much as he did.
When Paxton's top staff, his own deputies that he handpicked, finally blew the whistle on him, Paxton fired that group. They sued, and Paxton agreed to settle the lawsuit. Problem is, he asked the state legislature to pay that settlement. $3.3 million of taxpayer money.
He wants Texas to eat the money. I'm sorry, but unless Ken Paxton reimburses the state of Texas for what his actions cost us, then he's dead to me. I'm sorry. It's that simple.
David Leith is a Republican precinct chair in Collin County, one of the guests on this week's episode of Y'allitics, and evidence of the sharp division among Texas Republicans. Paxton denies he did anything wrong, and grassroots Republicans still support Paxton. They disregard the impeachment trial. Traditional conservatives, though, say let this rare process play out.
You've got two candidates there, both of whom have some really unsympathetic nature. How do you look at that race? Which one do you think is going to emerge from that? I'm going to put you on the spot a little bit. Which one do you think is going to win that primary, and who do you want to run against?
I honestly would relish the opportunity to prosecute the case against either Ken Paxton or John Cornyn. You know, I was a part of that bipartisan majority in the Texas legislature that impeached Ken Paxton. And you're right, his billionaire mega donors paid our lieutenant governor $3 million, literally a check for $3 million to get him off the hook. I'm very familiar with his crimes and his corruption, and would welcome the opportunity to make that case to the people of my state. But we oftentimes think of corruption as just involving money or involving something illegal. But that's not the case. And John Cornyn is a perfect example of that, because John Cornyn was the deciding vote on that big, ugly bill that kick millions of Texans off their health care. It'll literally take food out of the mouths of hungry Texas kids, all to fund tax breaks for John Cornyn's donors.
The Senate barely passed a spending and tax bill that would add trillions to the national debt. KINS 5 reporter Zach Briggs breaks down the potential impacts on low-income Texans.
San Antonio Food Bank CEO Eric Cooper has been keeping extra busy in Washington, pushing lawmakers to reconsider historic spending cuts to SNAP.
Just begging, right, that they make a decision to help families put food on the table.
The so-called Big Beautiful Bill includes more than $4 trillion in tax cuts. To help fill the gap, the federal food assistance program would be slashed by more than $180 billion. States would be required to foot the bill for a portion of SNAP benefits. Policy changes would also expand eligibility requirements, in turn potentially limiting access to SNAP.
It is the biggest betrayal of services to those that are vulnerable that I've ever seen in my 32-year career. We're literally taking money from the poor and giving it to the rich. It is the opposite of Robin Hood.
The Senate's bill, now being debated in the House, proposes reducing Medicaid spending by nearly $1 trillion. This could jeopardize healthcare access to more than a million Texans.
Between 1.6 to 1.8 million people, Medicaid cuts alone, the potential for 15 or more rural hospitals to close, which means you're now limiting health access.
Corruption is the betrayal of the public trust. It is the use of a public office to enrich the people who are funding your campaigns. And that's exactly what John Cornyn did on the largest scale. Yep. I mean, that is corruption of the highest order. And so I look forward to making the case against either one of those two Republican candidates. And I hope I give the opportunity as the Democratic nominee to do so.
You know, I have always admired the way you've approached public life and public service with sort of the centrality of compassion and of connection and of faith.
There is something broken in America. Our economy is broken. Our political system is broken. Even our relationships with each other feel broken. That's because the most powerful people in the world want it that way. My faith teaches me to love my neighbor as myself. Not just my neighbor who looks like me, or prays like me, or votes like me. I am called to love all of my neighbors like I love myself, because despite our differences, we all want the same things: a safe neighborhood, a good job, a quality, well-funded public school. And the ability
to see a doctor when we need one. But the billionaires who own the social media algorithms, who own the cable news networks, who own the politicians fighting on our screens, they want us at each other's throats. They want us focused on how we're different instead of on how we're the same. I am tired of being pitted against my neighbor. I am tired of being told to hate my neighbor. It's been more than 10 years of this kind of politics. Politics as blood sport. Politics as professional wrestling. It tears families apart. It ends friendships. And it leaves us all feeling terrible all of the time. There is a deep hunger in this state and in this country for a different kind of politics. Not a politics of hate, not a politics of tribes, not a politics of division, but a politics of love. A love that can heal what's broken in America.
How do you keep in this campaign, how do you keep those things in the foreground when they're going to come at you with every bit of the culture war noise and garbage and ugliness, because they don't have a lot more in the hopper anymore in terms of affirmative messaging? It always resolves down to the culture war at long last. How do you stay out of that minefield?
Well, I've always had two simple rules for political communications. Sometimes we overthink this stuff. My two rules are be yourself and tell the truth. And yep. I've found a lot of success with doing those two simple mm-hmm. things. So my faith is central to who I am. It's why I'm in public service, not just an elected office. I started my public service career as a middle school teacher on the west mm-hmm. side of San Antonio. And I signed up to do that difficult job because I am called to love my neighbors, especially the least of these. And so I'm not going to shy away from that part of my life. I have to be who I am, whether that rubs people the wrong way in my own party or causes people to be upset on the other side. I've got to be honest about why I'm in this and why I'm running. That said, I'm very cognizant of how organized religion has hurt a lot of people, and people have a lot of religious trauma, religious baggage, and I want to be sensitive to that. And I try to be very inclusive in how I talk about this, to include other faiths, to include my agnostic and atheist friends, mm-hmm. because at the end of the day, there are a lot of agnostics and atheists who are more Christ-like than Christian politicians in this country. But to your second question, I'm going to tell the truth about why these culture wars are at the front of our national conversation.
I think it's interesting. I've been in this race for 5 days and I've had a lot of interviews with national media. No one's ever asked me about the cost of housing. No one's asked me about the cost of prescription drugs. No one's asked me about the cost of childcare. The only thing the media wants to ask me about are trans athletes. And so what I would say is that the only minority destroying this country is the billionaires. Trans people are 1% of the population. Undocumented people are 1% of the population. Muslims are 1% of the population. We are all focused on the wrong 1%. Trans people aren't taking away our health care. Undocumented people aren't defunding our schools. Muslims aren't cutting taxes for themselves and their rich friends. It's the billionaires and their puppet politicians. And so we need not only the media, but all of us to focus on the real problem at hand.
The very powerful people, the billionaires who control our social media algorithms, who control the cable news networks, who control the politicians who are fighting on our screens, they want us to be at each other's throats. They want us focused on how we're different instead of on how we're the same, which I believe we're all much more the same than we are different at the end of the day. And so I'm going to call that out. I believe in treating voters like they're adults. I believe in shooting straight with them. And I think they are sophisticated enough to understand how they're being played. And so I'm going to be very honest about that. I started in our launch video talking about how we're being divided by the people at the top. And I'm going to continue to call that out when they try to push culture war fights on all of us.
I think that's as an ex-political guy or an ex-political strategist guy, I think that is exactly the right path. Is you've got to reframe this and not let it become the sort of tawdry trick that they used it very effectively against many Democratic candidates and against Vice President Harris in 2024.
Yep.
And they use that very effectively. So I think you're taking the right approach there. There have been a lot of shifts in the Hispanic population in Texas. And, you know, the Rio Grande Valley was something that for a long time the Republicans looked at with some jealousy. They managed to move a lot more votes down there than they did in previous elections. How does that factor into your calculus statewide about talking to folks in the Rio Grande Valley who tend to be, for those of y'all who aren't familiar with it, it tends to be a much more Hispanic area, first and second generation immigrants, high religiosity, many Catholics, many Pentecostals. How do you work with those folks down there to stop this erosion, the slide that's been going on with, because the culture war has been effective with a lot of those voters?
Well, my family is from South Texas, mm-hmm. And so I know the area like the back of my hand, and I'm going to spend a lot of time in South Texas in this campaign. We're going to be heading down there next week, actually, mm-hmm. Just to show that we are putting a priority on this region of the state. Because, you know, when I was a middle school teacher, I learned very early how to take responsibility. You know, if my kids in my classroom were misbehaving or if they weren't learning, it wasn't their fault, their kids. It was my fault as their teacher. And I take that into politics because oftentimes people in our party like to complain that, you know, voters have moved away from us. That's not the voters' fault. That is our fault as a party. If we are not speaking to their needs, if we are not providing a vision that they can see themselves in and can buy into, then mm-hmm. that's on us. And so, again, I'm not I don't think South Texas has changed. I think the Democratic Party has changed, and we are no longer speaking to their needs and their aspirations. And I hope that this campaign can start to change that.
You know, I think one of the things you have a real opportunity space on, and I've written about this a lot over the years, is that one of the things Republicans did to take power in various states, Florida, Texas, is they let people in districts be right for the district or be right for the state. They didn't say, you have to come down and meet this set of four or five criteria from the national party or from this group or that group. I think you're getting to the point where it's really, really smart is that you're not a cookie cutter Democrat. You're not a standard issue Democrat. You're a Texas guy who's going to go out, you know, run on the Democratic Party line, but represent people first as a Texan.
That's right. I am proud to be a Texas Democrat. I'm proud to be a part of a political party that still has principles, that still has a vision for how we can fix this democracy to make it work for regular people. But I already have a religion and I already have a sports team. The only reason I'm a part of this party is because I want to win political power to make people's lives better. And if the Democratic Party is not doing that, I'm going to call it out and I'm going to share hard truths so that we can get back on track and achieve the purpose of a political party. And I think for too long, people have treated the party as something other than that. And they forced people into these boxes. If you want a small, insular, pure group, then you should start a social club. But a political party has to be a big tent. It's got to be a coalition of people who don't agree on everything or don't come from the same backgrounds, don't come from the same perspectives. Politics is about addition and not subtraction if we hope to win elections again.
I think that's right. And I think that this is something that national Democrats running in any place in this country should be thinking about that. Like, how am I a Florida Democrat or a Oklahoma Democrat or a Nevada Democrat? How am I like state before party, country before, you know?
Yes.
It just scaling up the pyramid of connection to this is not the way to do it. It's scaling down to the local area.
And what a beautiful thing if our party is a mosaic of all kinds of Democrats from all different walks of life. I mean, that's what the Democratic Party used to be when we had a supermajority in this country in the New Deal era or in the Great Society era, when the last time a Texas Democrat led our party. You know, those were 60% majorities. We should not be in a position where we're within a couple percentage points of Donald Trump. We shouldn't be even close to that. I'm not interested in winning 51%. I'm interested in building a big enough majority in this country that can transform this democracy so it can actually work for people again.
You know, we talked a little bit in the beginning about the negative power of corruption, and the I've always said that corruption is kind of a killer app in a year where people need and feel the urgency of reform. And I think it's finally starting to connect with a lot of voters that the corruption in state houses around this country and in Washington, D.C., is the source of their pain. When you started to think about this campaign, have you been hearing that out there in the stump? I heard from some folks recently in a Midwestern state who said they had come out of the field and that people were finally starting to connect. Oh, yes. These lobbyists get their way.
Right.
But it's coming out of us.
Exactly. Again, this is back to treating voters like adults and not condescending to them, because people are smart. People can understand a lot if you give them a chance. And so oftentimes political consultants will be like, don't talk about process. You know, focus on kitchen table issues, whatever that means. And I've found, in my community that people are very open to understanding how this system is selling them out on a whole host of issues. And so I've tried to shoot straight with them that the reason we can't make progress on housing or on healthcare or on education or on the economy is because we have a broken political system that doesn't serve the interests of the people. And so getting to the core of the problem, getting to the heart of the matter, I think is essential. One, because it's true. And two, because we have to build a coalition big enough to change and transform that broken, corrupt political system if we hope to make people's lives easier and better.
Well, James Tallarico, tell everybody where they can find out more information about you and your campaign. Give them all the social media stuff that we got to do to get the word out.
Well, you can find me on all the platforms at James Tallarico. And then you can go to jamestallarico.com. You can sign up to donate. You can also sign up to volunteer. Even if you don't live in Texas, we will put you to work. And so if you want to be about a part of a campaign that you can feel good about and feel proud of, and a campaign that may be the difference between having a majority in the United States Senate and not, then please join us as soon as you can.
Yeah, I think that is so important to remember, folks. This is a race the NRSC did not see coming.
That's right.
They were sitting fat, dumb, and happy, and they sort of shrugged it off and said, oh, well, it'll be Corner or Paxton, whatever. And I can tell you this news has hit them like a lightning bolt. And so, James Tallarico, I wish you all the very best. Let's have you back on the program as this campaign goes on. Thank you so much for taking the time to come on the Lincoln Project podcast today.
Thanks, Rick. Appreciate it.
Folks, James Tallarico, who we just finished with a few seconds ago, was on a very tight schedule. And there's a reason for that. He had about 20 minutes to give us today. We're very grateful for his time. He has become something that has shocked the political system. God knows Beto O'Rourke is a great guy. Okay? Love him to death. But James has something, I think, that is of this moment that's going to put this race into play. The Republican Senatorial Committee, the NRSC, absolutely did not have this race on their radar screen a few days ago.
But I'm a former middle school teacher. I don't scare easily.
For the last 7 years, James Tallarico has served in the Texas House of Representatives, but now he's making the leap to run for U.S. Senate with an official announcement Tuesday.
I know how to win in tough areas. That is something that I bring to this race that I hope my party will hear.
In his campaign video, the former middle school teacher emphasized unity in running on a platform of representing the working class, regardless of political affiliation.
All of us want the same things.
But Tallarico has a past of clashing with Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott and President Donald Trump. The Senate hopeful says he doesn't see that as an issue for his campaign, touting support from Democrats, Republicans, and independents.
We say, you know, I may not agree with you on every single issue, but I'm with you in this fight.
Some Republicans, though, don't buy Tallarico's campaign message.
He's not talking about greater prosperity for everyone. He's talking about wealth envy. He's talking about billionaires. He's talking about us versus them.
Current Texas State Senator John Cornyn responded to Tallarico's announcement, saying Tallarico is another radical left-wing Democrat whose values do not align with Texans, and later called him an opportunist carpetbagger like Colin Allred.
I've always said I welcome anybody
into the race. Texans deserve a conversation, and I'm a competitor. I look forward to competition.
Allred is now not only campaigning against former astronaut Terry Virts, but now Tallarico as well.
We go from a situation where Colin Allred was the de facto nominee to one where we're going to have a very competitive statewide Democratic primary in March of 2026.
They didn't care whether it was Cornyn or Paxton. They would have preferred Cornyn overall, just because Paxton's a criminal and a weirdo and a freak. But they would have been fine with that. And they thought they had this in the bag. It was done. It's over. They were going to pour all their hate into other races. They were going to try to go in and burn down Mallory McMorrow and try to go in and burn down Cooper in North Carolina. Okay. Now they have to do a fight in Texas. 2026 is rapidly approaching. It's September, folks. We're going to watch as this economy continues to go into the ditch. And no matter how many times Donald Trump says, there's no inflation, jobs are... He's lying. The economy is in a perilous state.
The economy took another hit this week. The Bureau of Labor Statistics released a report showing that consumer prices were up 2.9% in August from a year earlier. On top of that, revised numbers show that the U.S. added almost a million fewer jobs than previously reported over the 12-month period ending in March.
The U.S. economy is getting worse. This trend line is no bueno. In November of 2024, when Donald Trump was reelected, it was 42%. Look at where we are now, up to 56%. The clear majority of Americans believe that the economy is getting worse. Less than a third think that the economy is getting better. This is a very, very troubling trend line. Hello, what's number one on your list? It's inflation. It's 34%. The economy, 16%. You add the two of those together, that is a majority, 50% of the American public who say either inflation or the economy is the top issue for them right now.
Trump's approval on the economy, though, keeps falling, now at 36%, with just 30% approving on his handling on the cost of living.
You've got 7 million Americans who are unemployed. You've got layoffs surging 40% last month alone. Donald Trump's policies are choking the American middle class, and Democrats have to take that and they have to incorporate that into their message. This economy is a complete disaster. You've got $1.2 trillion in credit card debt, largely because Americans are now relying on that and buy now, pay later, just to buy groceries in Donald Trump's economy. And so it matters. The economy always matters.
It's that scene in The Matrix where Neo says he's beginning to understand. He's the one. There are a lot of people out there who are thinking about running for office right now in the Democratic side who are starting to understand. You don't have to go out there and fight the culture war bullshit they'll throw at you. You have the idea and the ability to invert those things. You have the idea and the ability to take the strong side of the argument. You have the opportunity to become the pro-jobs party, the pro-growth party, the pro-worker party. You have the opportunity to go out there and become the pro-hospitals and healthcare party. You have the opportunity to go out there and become the party that doesn't want to see our kids get measles and mumps and rubella and die. You have the opportunity to go out there and become a party that says that the victims of Jeffrey Epstein and his companions and friends need to be held accountable. You have the opportunity to say that to the Republicans, yeah, okay, thanks for your culture war bullshit. But here's the real thing that's happening in this country, that millions, hundreds of millions of Americans are being screwed by a corrupt system in Washington and a corrupt system in many, many states, in the state houses, where your lives suck and your bills ain't getting paid and your kids aren't getting educated and your mom and dad had to move out of the nursing home and where you can't afford health insurance and where the hospital that was 20 miles from you is now 80 miles from you because they're closing hospitals. You have the opportunity to show Americans that if you're a Democratic candidate in 26. You have the chance to show them the way forward. Don't be trapped by what you think you need to be from some national PAC or party organization. None of it's real. You have the chance to be real for the people in your district, And whether that's a state House seat where you're going to win or lose based on 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000 votes out of 25,000, or a state Senate seat where maybe 400,000 people, 300,000 people, or whether it's a congressional seat where it's less than a million people, 795,000 people or so, you have the opportunity to be a new kind of leader. You should not be bound by the past. You should be what you should be in your state or your district. Don't worry about Bernie or AOC or any other factor in this party except what's in your heart, what the people of your state or your locality or your district need. Yes, those big national things affect what's happening in their lives, but you better know where every goddamn pothole is in your district. You better be able to make the case for how paying for a tax cut for Elon Musk or Jeff Bezos has hurt Bob Smith or Larry Hernandez in your district. You better be able to know every one of those rural hospitals that's closing in your area. Because you have a chance. You have a moment here. This is a year that, as tough as it may seem sometimes, where you can bring heat and heart to a campaign that goes up MAGA like nothing else before, that takes these people out. Because look, what are they selling? What are they selling? They're not selling the culture war. That's just a tactic. They're selling obedience to one man. You know what? That never fed a kid in your district. That never paved a road in your district. That never put a roof on a school in your district. It never helped a single person who wasn't selling t-shirts with that guy's face on it. Okay? Democrats watched Tallarico. Will he win? It's a red state, pink state. It's tough. He's going to have a hard campaign no matter what. But he can. He has that spirit. There are other people running. Cooper, North Carolina. He has the spirit. He has the fight in him.
We cannot let our progress slip away. We, the people, are the guardians of our beloved country and this treasured state. And despite all the turmoil and cruelty, because of people like you here tonight, I still believe that our best days are ahead of us.
And when people see you will fight for them, when people see you give a damn about them, you live in a different political world. Throw out the policy book, okay? When they send you the 300-page book about, well, here's my climate change plan or my healthcare plan or my gut, throw it out. Throw it out. No one cares. Talk to real people like they're real people. That's one thing Tallarico said in the very beginning of that conversation that I really enjoyed. Real people that he's willing to go and sit with and be where they're at. They get it. They're not children. And no Democrat in this country should think you're going to sell people with a policy book if they don't feel that your heart is with them. If they don't feel that that you get what they're getting in their lives in your gut. That's one of the great secret sauce things we as Republicans back in the day did. We told working class voters, oh, those Democratic elite eggheads hate you because they look down on you. I'm going to say something. A lot of Democrats did. Don't deny it, folks. A lot of Democrats did. They thought, we're the party of the college educated, and that will always be sufficient. You sure about that? You can't keep sawing off pieces of your coalition and saying, oh, well, we're going to lose those people because we don't like them. I'm going to give you some tough love right now, Democrats. There was an era in this country where you would not purge a member of your party over differences on an issue that you felt strongly about in New York, but that were political poison in the rural Midwest. You were smart for a few times back in the day. In 2017, Nancy Pelosi very wisely told every Democrat running, you do you for your district. Don't worry about Washington. You do you for your district. They were not all flaming progressives. Now, if you want to be a flaming progressive and you're in New York or Boston or San Francisco or whatever, awesome. Go kill it. That's right for your district. It's right for your area, right for your state. But you can't get a majority in the House of Representatives with just coastal cities. So you got to let people be what they are. And you got to meet people. If you're a candidate, you got to meet them where they are. You got to get there in their hearts and their minds in a way that doesn't let the Republicans frame you out as another elitist snob who hates the working class. This has always been the irony for me, is by any possible measure, the last 10 years, during MAGA dominance of our politics, have been objectively terrible for working class voters. Objectively terrible. And it's going to get much, much worse. It's not that, by the way, Republican voters hate the big government. Everybody hates big government. They hate government that they feel like the deck is stacked against them. They hate government that feels like corrupt people are getting things that they're not. If you're a candidate, it's not promising a bigger government. It's not promising programs or policies from a bigger government. It's about making it smaller and smarter and better, and about making it work for those people who feel like they've been left behind, who the Republican Party has told that the only solution to their grievances is to burn everything down. Keep an eye on Tallarico, folks. He's a very talented young man. He's a very talented candidate. And I don't mean that in that facile way of, oh, he's pretty good at the work. He's very good at the work, but he's also a good person. There's a goodness about this guy that I think you should watch and you should encourage other people to follow. He's exactly right. He's not there as a member of one social club that meets in Washington, D.C. He's a Texas Democrat first. So go out, Democrats, and be a Florida Democrat. Go out and be a Nevada Democrat or a Nebraska Democrat or a Missouri Democrat. There's no shame in that game. But run the way you got to run in your state or your district. All right, folks. Thank you so much, as always, for listening to the Lincoln Project podcast. We have been growing by leaps and bounds, and it is on you guys who've done that. I am so grateful. I can't even see straight. It's just an absolute honor every day to see how people respond to this podcast, the very kind notes, and both I and my production team who make this entire thing happen. I'm just a monkey who talks in front of a microphone. Whitney, Riley, Kate, absolutely crush it every week. And I know that they share my great and profound thanks to everybody who listens to this podcast. We'll be back again next time. I am super excited about some of the guests we have coming up. You are going to be blown away, and we are going to have keep up this fight every single day to save this country and to get us on the right path. And it's folks like you who are going to make it happen. Thanks so much, everybody. We'll talk to you again soon.
The Lincoln Project Podcast is a Lincoln Project production. Executive produced by Whitney Hayes, Ben Howe, and Joey Wartner-Cheney. Edited by Riley Main. Hey, folks, if you want to support the Lincoln Project's work against Donald Trump, Elon Musk, and this MAGA craziness, go to action.lincolnproject.us/helplp. If you'd like to get in touch or have suggestions for a guest or a show topic, or just want to say hi, our email is podcast@lincolnproject.us. For our MAGA friends, please, no more nudes. Thanks so much, and we'll talk to you again next time.
Good night, and good luck.